Hello, everybody. This is David Rovics with another episode of Discussions with David, which comes out pretty much one form or another, usually three times a week in some form, every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, most weeks in 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. in London at the moment until the time changes next week. Then it goes back to synced up by early November. This goes out every time on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, as well as KBOO Community Radio here in Portland, Oregon, and on various other platforms like YouTube, VK, LinkedIn, Twitch, and Facebook, and Periscope. What did I forget? Or repeat? I don't know. And then it goes out as a podcast if you look for This Week with David Rovics wherever you get your podcasts. Today we are spending the hour talking with Rabble, who has been very much involved with various events of the past few months in Portland, Oregon, and a lot of other things before that. And with that cryptic introduction, no further ado, Rabble, great to have you on the show.
It's wonderful to be on the show. I've been a massive fan of yours for decades.
Oh, thank you. And I think, yeah, that's, well, we, there's some, speaking of decades, there's, there's a lot to talk about. I wanted to also talk about some events of 20 years ago, which I think around the time we actually met. Yeah. But you've been very much involved with participating in events in Portland over the past several months in a particularly culturally relevant and wonderful way, I think, going around with a sound system, which I always say is an essential part of any protest. And I love how in Europe they have sound trucks, like at many of the in Germany and Denmark, it's very typical to have not just a sound system, but one mounted on a truck, a van size kind of thing.
Yeah.
But can you just give us a little bit of a sort of a retrospective of the past few months and your involvement in the protests? I know that's a huge question. There's a lot going on, and a lot of people most people are aware of the protests. Obviously they're following it and stuff. So, yeah. The fact that there are protests happening in Portland is not, give us a little picture.
Yeah. So it's kind of astonishing that we're now 5 months into these, nightly protests, and I actually remember the second week of the protests, or the first week in June, when it became a regular thing, and I had this revelation that we had the chance in Portland to do the kind of sort of transition from periodic protest or sort of spasm of protest into something that became a habit, something that became the normal thing that enough people did. And this is what we see in Hong Kong. This is what we see in Chile. This is what we see all over the world, where, Tahrir Square, all of these points in which the protest became part of people's everyday lives. And that's what it's felt like it's become in Portland, where you have a large group of people who support it, and then a core group of people who show up either every night or many nights a week. And it's been super powerful.
And there's just like so many little institutions involved with the whole thing, that people who have been involved with like the global justice movement or Occupy Wall Street or many other movements in the past 20 years and beyond are familiar with these kinds of sites. But can you talk about some of the different little groups that have formed? I don't know if they're affinity groups might be the term, although some of them are larger than what we might think of as an affinity group. But these little networks of different.
Yeah. So there's two sets of things. There are affinity groups, which are people, the smaller groups of people who get up and do a specific set of actions, or they support each other, or they go out to the protest together, and then we have these things called mutual aid groups, which sometimes are as small as affinity group and sometimes are larger. And the mutual aid groups have names that people recognize, and they perform various different roles. So there's a ton of medical, street medic mutual aid groups, one of which bought and runs an ambulance that they take sort of inside the protests so that it's staffed with licensed EMTs so that we can get people who are injured out of the protest zone to be put in, either taken directly to the hospital or put in an official ambulance, because the police aren't letting official ambulances into the protest zone.
Wow. And how are the police treating that ambulance? I mean, it looks like exactly like an ambulance. I didn't realize that that's the story behind it. But how are the when it's trying to leave with someone who's injured, are the police letting it through?
The police are letting it through. And interestingly, even though the ambulance says this is not an official ambulance on it, it is a ambulance vehicle with all of the ambulance equipment with, you know, EMTs and nurses and doctors, like licensed medical professionals practicing it. So it's not a registered ambulance, but every other vehicle we have, the police have been slashing the tires, and they haven't slashed the tires of the ambulance. Because it looks like an ambulance, now they've taken those ambulance workers, those activists, and severely beaten them up and arrested them, but they haven't hurt the ambulance itself.
When have they been slashing tires?
All the time. So
just right out in the open in front of everybody, just slashing tires?
Yeah. So what happened was, at the start of the protest, I would say one of the very first nights, we experienced these, we call them CHUDs, right-wing activists, who would take their cars and try and plow through the protests. And that happens so often that we've lost track of how many times it was.
And around the country, I mean, there have been some estimate, I don't know who, Politico or somebody estimated 70 cases of vehicular attacks like that, which seems like a very conservative number. I mean, they must be talking about the number of attacks that actually resulted in injuries, because as you say, this is constant.
In Portland alone. So what happened was, initially, we had vehicles going along with the protests that were providing water and snacks and medical equipment in case you got pepper sprayed or tear gas. And then those vehicles changed into something we call corking, which is putting vehicles as physical barriers on the blocks around it. And so it's bikes, motorcycles, and cars. And they're there to provide resources to the protest, but also to prevent this kind of vehicular attack. And when the cops charge, those vehicles attempt to get out of the way, and the top cops routinely slash those tires, so much so that a bunch of the vans carry full sets of four spare tires, inflated and mounted on rims to replace them right there. So like the full gear for tire replacement is carried in the vehicles, because it happens almost nightly.
And this is, I mean, just the amount of police brutality that's going on every night and the number of people who are being seriously injured every night is just astounding. I mean, just looking at the Twitter videos that people are putting out there, like Portland Documentaries and Sergio Olmos and various other journalists who are doing a lot of covering what's going on. I mean, it's just, it's amazing to me that there are still people coming out every night. Who's left, who's not, who hasn't been maimed, you know? I mean, how many people are there who are, it's hard to get a picture of this. I mean, because you're talking about so often, like dozens of people arrested and then maybe dozens injured. I mean, and regularly, nightly, yeah. Almost.
I mean, it happened last night. It's gotten to the point where there's so many broken bones that it barely registers. Initially, months ago, when an activist would break a bone or be hospitalized or have to go into surgery, it would be a big deal, and we would talk about it, and we would set up GoFundMe campaigns, and that still happens to some extent, but it's more normal now to be like, oh yeah, my arm was broken, or my hand was broken, or my leg was broken, and that just is on a regular basis. So we have, you know, people who weren't in wheelchairs now showing up to the protest in wheelchairs, and people who weren't injured now showing up in casts. We had one one Native woman who's an activist who was thrown to the ground and the cops sat on her and people were screaming and yelling. And then they had to call an ambulance for her at ICE last night. So, and that people talked about, people were concerned about, but it's so common now that it doesn't even register.
And also common is, as you mentioned, the police destroying so much property of protesters or anybody in the area, like destroying tires, and your sound system, which is a very nice sound system, has been confiscated now twice. And then when they take your sound system, and do they give it back or do they just take it?
So the first time they've not given it back because they didn't provide any documentation. They just walked up to me and grabbed it and didn't tell me anything. And then when I didn't let go of the speakers, they pepper sprayed me. So they don't know who owns the sound system. They don't know who they took it from. It was just literally a cop walking up to someone on the street and stealing their stuff. The second time I was actually given a noise citation and a property receipt, so I was able to get the speakers back. But
were they destroyed when you got them back?
They weren't destroyed, but they were in worse shape than I got them. And but I also, you know, took the speakers apart, looked inside, made sure that there weren't, you know, that they didn't do anything to them. And frankly, I think although there are federal agents who are quite sophisticated, the Portland police themselves are not very sophisticated in what they do.
Would have been a great place to plant a bug.
I mean, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. And both times that they confiscated your sound system, and one of those times they pulled your mask off and sprayed you with mace in the face. Is that right? But the other time they didn't do that?
The other time they didn't do that. And I don't know why. I think the first time it wasn't ordered, just some cop decided to do it. And I think the second time it was an order from someone in police command to shut the music down, because they came over to me in force. They actually talked to me. They told me that you're giving me a citation. And if I came with them, they would give me a property receipt to claim the property back. But then once they were trying to give me a citation, they didn't know what to cite me for. Like, they were literally sitting there on their phone trying to Google the city and state regulations to figure out what my charge was. And they ended up giving me something that isn't relevant. Like, they gave me a charge for operating a vehicle with too loud a sound system, but I was standing on the sidewalk, so there was no vehicle there.
It was just the closest charge they could find, I guess. And both times you were playing the patriotic music, one case the national anthem.
So the first time I was playing Beyonce's Star Spangled Banner from the Obama inauguration, and
it's not even a mocking version of the national anthem. It's a straightforward, really well performed rendition.
Exactly. And then the second time I played Hendrix's national anthem, the Star Spangled Banner, which is obviously much more critical.
Yeah.
And then Beyonce's America the Beautiful from, again, the inauguration. And, you know, it's fascinating because I get a fair amount of criticism and negative feedback from fellow protesters about how these songs are based on the United States' tradition of genocide and slavery and white supremacy and misogyny, and the people who created them have all these problematic backgrounds. And I know all that. But what it does is it upsets the police in some profound ways that all of our more militant protest songs don't.
And I assume most of the protesters can tell this is very well-chosen stuff. I mean, you're not getting criticized too much by people, are you?
No, I don't get criticized by people on the ground. I get lots of criticism of online people. There's a huge number of people who don't show up to the protests, don't participate in the organizing, but do talk a lot online. And because
so bizarre.
From home, they feel like they're part of it. And I would encourage everyone who is sitting and watching at home to put on a mask, get out there and join us, or join them where you are, because you're not actually, like, you may feel like you're part of the protest by watching from your home, but you're not.
No, and especially when you realize that we're talking about oftentimes only dozens of people on a slow night, right? And yeah. I mean, you know, so which is I often notice on Twitter that many of the videos of police brutality on any given night, after a few hours, they've gotten thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of views, and you know, which is just such a massively larger number than the number of people who are actually there, you know, which is kind of, yeah. I mean, it's a bit strange.
Yeah. And when you ask, like, who's able to keep coming out to this, the answer is not a ton of people.
Yeah.
But it's a small committed core of people who are out here, willing to put their bodies on the line, willing to face arrest. We elected a progressive district attorney who is refusing to pursue a bunch of the police charges for things that would never get convictions anyway, you know.
Yeah, but he's, unlike many other DAs, he's not trying to drag the whole thing through the courts for years and terrify people and have prison sentences hanging over their heads and drain the resources of people. I mean, that's quite a move, dropping the charges, and the police have been very upset with him, and their tactics have changed since the DA dropped charges on protesters. Do you think the police have noticeably become more brutal?
Yes. So the police have become more brutal. The police see their punishment as the arrest process and the repression.
Because they know the charges will be dropped.
But the other thing that's happened is the governor let the police become federally deputized. And then the police and the federal government lied to the governor and the mayor and deputized them not for a weekend, but through the end of the year. And so now, I saw there's this pair of musicians, Trumpet Man and No Shoes. And Trumpet Man plays a trumpet, and No Shoes does freestyle. And a week ago, they literally just sat down in a sidewalk in front of a line of cops, completely calmly. And the cops walked up to them, they picked them up, they arrested them. And they were charged with felony assault of a federal officer. And it's all on video. And, like, it was the epitome of nonviolent passive resistance. And what we're seeing is basically these Democrats in Oregon denouncing the Trump administration and then handing over the policing to the Trump administration, where everybody's facing really serious federal charges.
Really serious federal charges. And they, and what they are, in so many cases, first being attacked by the police for doing in Portland and all over the country, is just marching in the street. That is, I mean, we're just talking about taking a street, which is the most basic. I mean, and of course, as you know, well, lately they've been attacking people in the parks before people even leave the park to go on a march, but just marching in the street, which is many, many, many parts of the world, is just a standard kind of thing. If people march in the street, the police form an escort to make sure there are no traffic accidents. And that's all they do. And that's just standard procedure in lots of different countries, as well as in San Francisco, but in Portland and most of the rest of the U.S., marching in the street in a city controlled by Democrats in a state controlled by Democrats is going to get you viciously attacked.
And to be perfectly honest, half the time we're no longer marching in the streets. So there's been 5 months of tremendous tactical and strategic variation in attempts. The police are trying all these different things. The protesters, we're trying a ton of different things. For example, last night, we actually marched on the sidewalk all the way to the ICE building. And in front of the ICE building, the vast majority of the protest was on the sidewalk. There were some people in the street, maybe half the people in the street, not blocking it, letting traffic through, not blocking traffic. There's in the past, there's been water bottles mostly and occasionally other things thrown. But for the last week or two, there's been essentially no throwing of anything either. Like, because we discovered that when we throw water bottles, the police go and collect rocks and claim that rocks were thrown. And we have videos of the police collecting rocks. And we have no videos of anybody throwing rocks. Like we've never seen, like, they constantly claim that we're throwing rocks, but there's no evidence of it. But we do have evidence of them collecting rocks that they claim were thrown. And so at this point, no one is even throwing rocks, or no one's throwing water bottles. No one's throwing anything. The most aggressive thing that is happening is a couple nights ago, everyone was attacked and pepper sprayed and beat up for tying heart-shaped balloons to the fence of the ICE building. And last night there was a bit of graffiti. And it's
just a total zero tolerance of any kind of any most minor infraction. Balloons, yeah. Tying balloons to a fence.
The tying balloons, and honestly, the most often thing that people are arrested for is simply not running away quickly when the police charge the crowd, or targeted arrests for people that are very vocal about yelling at the police.
And sometimes they say, I ask people, have you been to any protests lately? And they say, oh, no, I'm not up for running at the moment. Like, my leg's been acting up, you know, I got to wait until I can run again. You know, this is the reality. If you can't run fast, then you're in potentially really more danger. Huh?
Yeah, and it's very much a sprint. Last night I watched a bunch of people be chased by the cops, and the cops gave up after two blocks.
The police are generally encumbered with a lot of equipment, but still,
yeah. We're now encumbered with a lot of equipment too.
That's right. Huh? More and more.
Almost everyone is wearing ballistic vests, often with ceramic or steel plates, which are 15 or 20 pounds. And then you have to have a backup that includes a change of clothes, a gas mask, a helmet, a bullet wound kit, a Sudocon for pepper spray, backup equipment for, you know, changes of clothes for when your clothes get covered with pepper spray. Like, it's a lot of gear that you have to safely protest.
And this weighs you down. And then also another problem with having the gear is then the police target people for having gear, right? If you have a helmet, or they figure,
because everybody has it.
They stopped. That's, yeah, okay. Interesting. Now,
now that everyone is wearing ballistic vests, you don't get targeted for wearing a ballistic vest.
There's some kind of poetry in that statement, but I'm not quite sure what it is yet. That's a really, wow, gosh. And
it's inaccessible. Like, there's a problem when you need several hundred dollars of specialty protective gear to attend a protest.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, if people who are paying attention to international news are aware that just several hours ago, there were at least 20 people gunned down by the police in Nigeria for doing exactly what people are doing in Portland and, you know, taking to the streets. And of course, maybe if they had more, if they were all wearing the vests that people are now bringing to Portland protests, perhaps there'd be a slightly smaller death toll. But gosh.
I mean, the vests only cover your chest, so and your back. It doesn't cover everything. So it's better than nothing, but it is not enough. And we're definitely having people shot at protests.
And people are, and the police are often aiming for the face with tear gas canisters anyway. So, but then people, and talk about the people getting shot at protests. I mean, of course, you know, this is increasingly, we're talking about right wingers coming, driving around in pickup trucks with huge flags and attacking people with bear mace and driving around with loaded assault weapons.
Yeah.
And then,
and firing them.
And firing them. At it like above crowds, into crowds. There was, I heard a report about actually firing into a crowd, and somehow nobody got seriously hurt. But there's been arrests as well. Some of the far right have been arrested and are now in prison or in jail with a $500,000 bond or whatever it's called.
Bail. Yeah, Alan Sweeney, he's one of the leaders of the Portland Proud Boys. The Proud Boys claim he is not a member, but he has a Proud Boy tattoo on his arm. And
at least an honorary member.
Yeah. And, so they're public leaders. Some of them have been this guy, Teeny, from protests before, violated his parole and now is in jail, and Alan Sweeney's in jail and a few of the others are in jail. But, for example, about a month and a half ago at the sheriff's office in Laurelhurst, one of the neighborhoods in Portland, one of these guys drove up in a pickup truck, started throwing things at protesters. Protesters chased the vehicle away. The guy got out of the car, shot one of the protesters through the side of, in his back and out through his belly. The cops picked him up, took the both the shooter and the gun victim, the victim, to the hospital, and let them go and did everything they could to be no press coverage. So, and a few days later, the kid is back out with bandages over his bullet wounds into an exit room, running from the cops back at the protest. So, like, it's not just that they've been threatening to shoot or that they've been, you know, like, that has been going on. And often, if it happens any part away from the cameras, then everyone claims it didn't happen.
And what are your feelings about how polarized society is becoming outside of the protest? Because I'm also getting the impression, like, not even anywhere close to a protest, but just like around different neighborhoods in Portland, that like the far right is more and more activated and vocal. And like when I'm going postering around rent strike stuff, around eviction defense stuff around the city, the response that I get when I go to outer southeast is every time I go to outer southeast, I get yelled at by people in pickup trucks. And I'm not even wearing, I'm just dressed the way I'm dressed right now, and I'm putting up posters. So I'm not even, like, you know, wearing a target on my back that says I'm a protester. I don't think, unless wearing black these days qualifies you as a, you know, protester.
So, you know, it's fascinating that so in the inner neighborhoods of Portland, you have everybody who will say they support Black Lives Matter, except for in the South Waterfront, which is this new neighborhood around where the ICE detention facility is, which is all sort of fancy glass and steel buildings. There, we get some support, but we also get people throwing bottles out of their apartment windows down on the protest on a regular basis.
Glass bottles?
Glass bottles, yeah. Sometimes full glass bottles.
Potentially deadly.
Sometimes bottles, sometimes beer bottles, sometimes empties. And that pretty much happens every time we protest in that neighborhood. In the sort of southeast, where the East Precinct is, you see that kind of sort of blowback. And we saw one woman put up a swastika flag or sticker in her window when the protest went by. But we also see the vast majority of houses, people come out and they tell every protester that goes by, you can come onto my lawn, you can come into my house, if you need hiding, this is where we protect you. And you see that all the time. What you don't see is people doing that in the wealthiest neighborhoods. In the wealthiest neighborhoods, they have the Black Lives Matter signs, but they're not coming out of their houses and taking action to support the protesters.
With the wealthy neighborhoods with the Black Lives Matter signs, I mean, of course, not to blame wealthy people for all the problems of capitalism and displacement and gentrification, but it often seems like I'm often reminded of 1992 around the LA riots, and all over the country, people were putting signs in their windows saying guilty in businesses, that the police who beat Rodney King so viciously and were found not guilty, that they were guilty. And it often felt like the more glass you had in your windows, the more signs you wanted to put up to in the hopes that they wouldn't be smashed. And sure. And I thought that was maybe the main motivation for a lot of people.
I think that that's a motivation for a lot of the businesses. I think also people want to feel like they're supporting it. They want to feel like they're doing something. They want to feel like they're a good person. And it's easy to see how police brutality and extrajudicial killings are not good things, even if they're unwilling to actually support people engaged in social change around it. They want to feel like they're on the good side.
Yeah. Yeah. There's that too. And did you hear the news? Some local outlet reported that police Sergeant Krueger is the highest paid officer on the force in Portland. And he's also noted for being a fascist.
And not someone we just say has far right authoritarian ideas, so we call him a fascist. Like swastikas and Nazi reenactment and Nazi memorabilia collector, and has been known to graffiti swastikas in parks. Like, he's a fully avowed Nazi.
And somehow he's the highest paid cop on the Portland police force. And are there particular police who are constantly recommitting violent offenses? Is it would you say it's a particular group among the police, or is it just widespread among the ranks of the police?
Ironically enough, because even with the the chance of all cops are bastards, even with the fact that it's an institutionalization and there's this sort of blue wall of silence that protects the cops, we actually know who the particularly abusive cops are. And the worst abuser is this guy named Brent Taylor, who actually, so they keep attempting to hide their identity. And so they remove their names, and then they remove their badge numbers, and then they put on another six or seven digit number that identifies the police officer, but refused all public information requests on who those officers were. And so, this guy is, embraced being a bad cop and chose number 12 for his number, which is of course the code for the narcotics division. And he's part of the rapid response team, which is the riot cops that we most often see. And so he's the one who often is caught on video after they've cuffed someone, just punching him in the face for minutes on end, throwing people to the ground, slashing tires. And there's another half dozen of them who are particularly egregious. They're particularly violent. And the police, on a regular basis, announce that these officers have been reassigned. They, it's several different times that they said, well, officers that have committed these things, we've reassigned them off of the rapid response team, or we're investigating, or we've reassigned them to desk duty. And that reassignment seems to last about a day.
And then they're back beating protesters.
They're back beating protesters almost immediately. So it's just so they can
get the PR.
Yeah, it's just PR about, and they never name them specifically. There's no specific investigations, and the internal review process that Portland has is completely toothless. And the Citizens Commission has had most of its members quit multiple times this year. So they've gone through several cycles of people showing up, participating in this commission, discovering that it's a farce, and quitting.
And now on another note, when you mentioned the review board, in terms of electoral politics, it's looking like one of the most critical people in the city council in terms of the police, Chloe Udaly, might be potentially losing her seat. And I hope that doesn't happen, but it's the police union guy is running against her and doing better, seems better funded, getting lots of donations.
Chloe Udaly is a progressive activist who got elected on an insurgent campaign. She hasn't been perfect, but she's done lots of environmental policies, and she's been good about supporting and advocating for police reform. She had a policy of pushing forward basically banning single-family zoning in Portland and saying that every lot can have up to 4 units. And that the neighborhood associations wouldn't get veto over rental property being put into neighborhoods or higher density housing. And so the police unions and the neighborhood associations and the business association, this sort of collection of everybody who doesn't want Portland to be inclusive or progressive, got together and found a black man to run against her. And so what we have is a sort of center-right black politician running against a progressive left woman. And it looks like she's going to lose. And it's a tremendous disappointment, and it will make further reforms more difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. Very well put. I wish she could have put it as well as you just put it, you know, in that debate I just heard on NPR on OPB between the two of them. I thought neither one of them did a great job of presenting their own case, you know. But maybe I'm just too much of a critic. Politicians are always so careful about everything they say, you know, even if they're not even in office yet. It's like there's this thing about even at a local level, it seems like they're just paralyzed with fear about the possibility they might say a word that's going to get tweeted by the wrong person, and who knows, you know, what's going to happen. I don't know. I've never been a politician, so I don't know about that level of caution.
It sounds like it would be horrendous to be a politician and have to deal with that, because the entire system is set up so that they can't be honest.
That's right. Yeah. And a system of legalized bribery and a lot of other things. Can you talk about when you first decided that you were going to be the guy bringing a sound system to the protests every night?
I had heard other people bringing speakers to the protests, and then I did some research online and I found some battery powered speakers, and I bought them. And then one of the other activists, when the feds, so I brought them out occasionally. And would play music, sort of soundtrack. And then one of the other activists was holding a speaker standing on the sidewalk across the street from the federal building playing music. And the feds shot him in the face, Donovan LaBella. And he was seriously injured and went to the hospital and was hospitalized for a long time. And has had to have multiple rounds of reconstructive surgery. And that showed me, one, how powerful the music is, and sort of reinforced it as a soundtrack to it. And I've been aware that music is critical to social movements for a long time, but the shrinking of the size of batteries and of speakers getting louder and being more portable and higher quality has gotten us to the point where we're able to have sound truck level audio in something that you can either carry around in your hands or carry around in a backpack. And so after Donovan got shot and injured, I felt like it was important that we didn't sort of let that end and didn't let them attack and injure people with speakers and didn't let them kill that part of the protest. So that was the point at which I made sure that every night I brought out the speakers and brought out the sound and started cultivating a set of sound around the protest, around like augmenting the mood and augmenting the sense of what was going on. And so many times there'd be a shield line or a line of umbrellas, and I'd be there holding an umbrella and also the speakers playing different stuff, and people would request things. And we also started hearing increasingly these sort of indignant authoritative announcements over the police's LRAD. So the police have this long-range acoustic weapon that they used as a weapon for a few nights, and then it was determined that it wasn't legal and they were banned from using it. And that the mayor and the state government have banned the police from doing a lot of things that they haven't stopped doing. So I'm not quite sure why they stopped using the LRAD, because just because it was illegal wouldn't stop them. But
now they're federally deputized anyway, so they can use tear gas, even though the mayor has technically supposedly banned it, although he didn't really. He just banned CS gas, but not other forms of chemical weapons. So it's
And including ones that are much more serious. Occasionally the feds use one, HW, which is like a much more serious, much more intense one. And so we get these announcements, and then we had people yelling back, and there was a real obvious disproportionate power. So we started talking online and started recording counter announcements. And this has been super effective. We've had a whole series of counter announcements that play back at equivalent or louder volume than what the police do. And so when they come to do announcements about stay on the sidewalk or unlawful assembly, or hey, you graffitiing the building, stop it, or hey, you in red, we see you, we're gonna come get you, or move to the west, all these orders, we have both announcements that satire what they're saying, provide a voice for the protest against it, and drown out their announcements. So it makes it effectively sort of ineffective for their announcement, because no one in the protest can hear what they're saying anyway.
Love it. Do you have any background as a DJ?
None at all.
So, I mean, because it strikes me that like what you're doing is basically you're being a DJ, but in a completely different circumstance than the overwhelming majority of DJs have ever thought about. You know, I mean, as a DJ, you're largely sort of, I would imagine, I've never been a DJ either, but you're kind of like creating the mood, or you're maybe aiming to be creating the mood, and perhaps maybe you're bouncing the music off of the mood that's already there in the room. But the situation outdoors at a protest with riot police is a much more volatile, so many different considerations in terms of the mood. Like, I mean, because potentially with the music, do you feel like you could really be a force for sometimes escalation or de-escalation of a situation?
Totally. I mean, I feel awkward about it, but it has a tremendous amount of power to shape the situation. I actually heard a public radio thing talking about the Portland Trailblazers, the basketball team here, and how their audio team uses music and sound clips and reads the cloud and reads the game to try and move the mood along in the arena. And I feel like what I'm trying to do in the protest is very similar. So yeah. Trying to find, when do we need calm music? When do we need powerful music? What is this protest focused on, and how do we get those themes? How do we get music which is evocative? How do we get music that can be understood as what it is and recognized when there's a lot of chaos going on? So subtle music, or pretty much all punk music that's got a thrasher type feel, doesn't work, because you aren't directly listening to it. And so all you hear is the noise and the energy, and things with really strong beats work.
Right. Something more minimalist in a way works better.
Minimalist, something recognizable, something with really strong refrain, something where either the instruments are powerful or the voice is powerful. But if they're both happening at the same time, at the same level, you can't distinguish them in a protest.
That makes a lot of sense. And it's such a fascinating thing to orient around, I think. And I thought that conversation with the Trailblazers sound people was very interesting. All this talk about how to do create atmospheres during the pandemic. Of course, this is why they're talking about this stuff so much again, and the laugh track and the applause track and all that.
Like we literally have a laugh track. Like, I have a laugh track that is one of the things I play during police announcements.
To laugh at their announcements. Excellent. And you play a lot of, during the more slower moments as things are building, you play a lot of speeches, huh? By all sorts of...
I've gone through, the abolitionist movement has been around for quite a while, both working on police and prison abolition. And so... I went through and found a whole ton of speeches from the Critical Resistance Conference, from the Allied Media Conference, and from Alicia Garza and the founders of the Movement for Black Lives, and took their speeches and edited out the parts where they were talking about the audience of where they were. And I play them, and the most powerful one, I would say there's two that are most powerful. One is Alicia Garza's commencement speech at UCSF on why Black women are magic. And it names all these Black women, and it re-centers the struggle and how it's been, the core, the heart of it has been Black women. And it's only 6 or 7 minutes, but it's super powerful. And then the other one is by Walid Ismail, and she is a Portland-based radical activist and author. She co-edited the anti-globalization book, Another World is Possible. She co-edited Octavia's Brood, the collection of fiction based on Octavia Butler's work. And she is also a history professor, and so she has a 20-minute talk on the history of legal white supremacy in Oregon and why Oregon is based on white supremacy. And people don't know that. Even lots of Black activists come up to me and talk about how they didn't know the history.
Yeah.
So I either play that when we're hanging out in the park before a protest, or I play it at moments where the crowd has been partially cleared and it's not back together chanting, or I play it just at the police when sometimes there's a few protesters around and a lot of police standing around, and I'm like, well, I guess you're going to get a history lesson again.
Yeah. It's just a fantastic way to do popular education as well as play the role of DJ in the more active situations. I mean, it's a wonderful multiple role that you can play doing that. And you've also recently set up a website where you make publicly available a lot of the material you've been broadcasting. And where can people find that?
Yeah, so it's at Soundblock, SoundBlock. CARRD.co. Or if you just go to SoundBlockPDX on Twitter, you can also find a link to it. And it's got a link to SoundCloud, so all the audio that we produced ourselves, and then a link to most of the playlists that we play off of Spotify, although there's a number of songs that we found off of YouTube and re-edited, or found off people sharing on social media. We pulled songs off of TikTok. Not all of that stuff is on Spotify. And so occasionally I'm playing stuff that I haven't been able to share.
But Spotify is the platform that you set stuff up on, because of all the platforms, it's where most stuff is, right? I mean, it's kind of a super highway.
It's a terrible system. Like, people blame Spotify as screwing musicians and screwing artists, and it's true. And the reason Spotify does it is because Spotify is actually owned by the labels. Like Spotify was a company that said, how do we get streaming work? We're going to give all of the music labels significant ownership in the streaming platform. And so consumers are charged. The money goes to Spotify, but mostly actually to the music labels. And then the music labels choose to give almost none of it to the artists. So, I mean, that's another the terrible part of capitalism, but it also has the songs that are easily available. And I have the custom recordings and custom edited songs and counter announcements in the iOS, the Apple Music app, and I have the Spotify ones. And that way I can switch back and forth without losing track of where I am, depending on whether or not I need to yell at the cops or play music.
Yeah, great. And one of the things that's been happening in a big way over the past few months is this the protests that initially had a pretty much a clear focus around police brutality and institutional racism, and really they still do, but that concept of institutional racism is becoming more and more inclusive to include lots of other aspects of institutional racism, such as gentrification and displacement of Black people in the housing market in Portland, and that's also been something you've been plugged into. And I wonder if you can talk about some of the ways that the movement is changing over the past few months.
So the movement was always deeply intersectional. The
right.
movement was always aware of that stuff. But the thing that brought people together and brought people out of the streets was the issue of institutional racism and police brutality. And so as we've been going through this protest, we're looking at ways to connect it to other things. And in particular, there is a house owned by an Afro-Indigenous family in North Portland, where that has owned it for generations, where the bank or the mortgage company committed mortgage fraud. They basically, robo-signed documents and committed fraud, and then have been foreclosing on the family's house and trying to evict them. And this is exactly the kind of thing that happens to BIPOC families, where they are disempowered and pulled out of the housing market and then pulled out of the ability to have intergenerational wealth. And so that family has reached out to the Black Lives Matter movement and set up a 24/7 encampment at the house and at the empty lot next to it. And the area is zoned for condos, and there's like a 4 or 5 story condos around it. And so that property, although they only owe $90,000 on this loan that they're trying to evict them for, if the bank can get rid of them, it's worth many millions of dollars. And so we have an ongoing long camp with movies and educational nights and food and services there, that in effect, it is our autonomous zone, but it's an autonomous zone not about claiming public space, but about defending Afro-Indigenous space. And it's been super powerful.
Mm-hmm. And when we're talking about the nature of the, having to use platforms like Spotify and iTunes, and it's sort of inevitable that we have to, but I wonder, one of the issues that's always going on with movements that are trying to grow and go get organized is how we all communicate with each other. And this is something that you also have been involved with in various ways for the past 20 years, at least. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about different forms of communication and that the corporate platforms and how to try to liberate ourselves from them to whatever extent possible.
I mean, there's the classic, you can't dismantle the master's house with the master's tools. And like, although in this protest, I've been very involved with the music, my actual long-term activism is much more related to technology. And so in the mid-1990s, I started getting involved with setting up tech collectives that would provide services to activists, SquatNet in Europe, RiseUp, DAO in Canada, and those tech collectives, along with media activists doing pirate radio, doing like free speech TV, print journalists that coalesced in 1999 with the creation of Indie Media. And I was very involved with the creation of Indie Media, where we said, we need to stop asking journalists to cover our stories. We need to be the journalists. We need to make creating media as essential to building what we do. And we were very clear that what we needed to do was build our own platforms. And we essentially pioneered live streaming from the streets. We pioneered the self-publishing. We pioneered the ideas and the technology of social media. And then much better funded Silicon Valley companies took those ideas and brought them to the larger world, but they brought them to the world in platforms they control. And so we, you know, there's a whole community of us who've been since then building things like Mastodon, building encrypted communication stuff. Signal comes out of this community. Moxie's a long-term committed anarchist. I've been involved with this thing called Scuttlebutt and have an application called Planetary.social, which is a decentralized, privacy-focused social network that you can do the same things as you do on Instagram or Twitter, but you control your identity, you control your relationships. There isn't the company that controls these things, and it bases its governance model for how we manage these spaces, not on the shopping mall model of like it's privately owned, like what Twitter, Facebook, Instagram are, nor like the state regulation that you have for Chinese things where the government just decides who can say what, but instead a commons model where you have community governance and you have sort of a healthy process by which you define who can participate in these communities and what is acceptable behavior. And commons is something that we on the left have been building and fighting for and understanding as an alternative. And so now we're building that in our digital spaces so that we can control it and so that we're not reliant on these large platforms that don't support us and extract tremendous value. And if push comes to shove, will turn on us.
Yeah, and do all the time, really. I mean, they already have, right? I mean, the algorithms are destroying society, I'd say, to no small extent. But I mean, what about when one of my relatively recent discoveries, and I know this probably, you know, makes me obviously a Luddite compared to so many others, but like I just discovered Reddit only just like last year. And I think it's as these platforms go, it's so much better organized than Facebook in terms of actual communication. But the problem, not such a problem with Reddit, but with so many other smaller initiatives, is there's so few people using them, right? So like when I got banned from Facebook for promoting a band that has a name that apparently we can't talk about in public, I lost half of my audience. I mean, in terms of, you know, really just literally lost half my audience.
Platforms, and they're arbitrary and there's no legal recourse, and that's a massive problem. We see it in the most vulnerable communities. So we see it happening to people being political right now, but it happened to people doing sex work long before this. It happened to all the queer and trans kids who wanted to post photos of themselves long before this. And if we want a revolution where we're actually contesting and seizing power and replacing the systems, we have to realize that the system that we're replacing will use every tool that they have. And as long as they can delete our accounts, as long as they can ban and block us, we'll lose. And so it's critically important that we build sort of dual power in technology as well.
Do you mind if we go a couple minutes over the hour here? Because can we talk about the way that the social media corporate platforms have changed over the years that have made them so much more dangerous than they were when they started?
Sure. So in my personal experience, I went from working on indie media stuff to working on this. I took a programming gig to try and raise some money to pay for myself. And was worked on the startup called Odeo, that was helped invent podcasting. And podcasting in the mid-2000s was a very new emergent thing, and it wasn't clear what it was going to be, but it has democratized radio in a really powerful way. At the same time, a group of us with indie media and other tech activists had created this thing called TextMob, which was for text updates. And for people who were at the RNC protests in 2004, they might remember getting indie media updates from it. And it was also used in 2005 and 2006 for the May Day immigrant general strikes. What happened was the company that was Odeo had several of us who were anarchists working on these tech platforms for social change, looked at it and said, oh, this is really cool. How can we build it in a way that isn't just for activists? And that work of adapting the anarchist activist tech platform and adding some new features is what became Twitter. And so Twitter is used for political organizing and used for protests, not because the protesters are readapting Twitter. That's the original use. And everything else is people who are adapting a protester's platform. But unfortunately, the tools we built as activists didn't have the resources and funding and didn't have the decision-making process and the way of producing it that let us build these as free software and autonomous systems. And so we built the models, we did the innovation, and then the companies took them over. And often it was the same sets of people. YouTube had a very early person who was very involved in New York indie media, who figured out like how the social aspect of YouTube worked. Craigslist, Flickr, Twitter, and a ton of these other ones all had core indie media people building it with the hope that we could build, have more resources and build our values into it. And that has worked in some ways. But over time, all of those anarchists and radicals who were there get kicked out of the organization once there becomes a lot of value. And they refocus it on surveillance, on ads, and they're then deciding what speech and what activity is available based on their need for profit and their need for stuff. And so now you see Facebook, which, you know, had in Chris Hughes a lefty gay man as one of the co-founders, and we don't have Chris Hughes, the leftist queer activist, running Facebook, even though he's one of the co-founders. Instead, we have Mark Zuckerberg, who is perfectly happy to embrace the Republican agenda and delete content and block content that isn't, you know, in line with keeping the Republican Party happy. And so what happened is the markets and capitalism took this thing and enclosed it and made it its own. And, you know, it's a classic enclosure. It's just like enclosing the commons.
Right. It's very much the technological version of enclosing the commons, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then lastly, I mean, the platforms, that when we're talking about the corporate social media platforms, as a user, it seems like YouTube and Facebook are much more insidious and dangerous than Twitter or Reddit, like in terms of the way that they're structured. And can you talk about that? Do you think that's true? And if so, can you explain why?
So corporate culture matters. Who works at these companies matter. What their history matters. How they view themselves matter. Jack Dorsey, for all of our frustration about him not deleting Trump's account and not taking neo-Nazis seriously enough and everything else, when Ferguson happened, he was on a plane to St. Louis and out there in the protests with everyone. He grew up in St. Louis, and like the next day he was there in the protest. Not like he tweeted about it a little bit, but it wasn't about him. He was there to be a protester, a white man showing up in solidarity. And I think that set of values is super important. And he's still within a market. He's still dealing with capitalism. He's still dealing with the constraints. But it drew other people who are mission-driven, who see their role as engaging in positive social change. In Reddit's case, one of the Reddit co-founders was Aaron Schwartz, who led a lot of the, like, after co-founding Reddit, led a lot of the internet freedom campaigns. He started all sorts of movements. He helped create Creative Commons. He was a genuine tech activist. And he ended up releasing all of the JSTOR, all of the scientific articles. He went to MIT and he snuck into a computer lab and he downloaded all the scientific papers and was releasing them free on the internet. And then the federal government prosecuted him and was threatening him with many felonies and life in jail, and basically harassed him to the point where he committed suicide. And so and Jack Dorsey spent the 90s on like radical feminist message boards and like, you know, has, you know, he doesn't widely show it, but has, you know, feminist and anarchist themed tattoos. Like, even if he's now a very wealthy billionaire corporate CEO, he has in his background that he was part of these social movements.
And then the way the platform functions also, I mean, that's reflected in the way it functions, it seems to me, because, I mean, with Twitter, it's like, for example, it's just basically a chronological feed of what people you follow post, which is not at all what YouTube or Facebook is.
Yeah. And Twitter does let you choose an algorithmic feed that tries to highlight stuff, but it lets you choose the chronological one. And what happened with YouTube is that YouTube didn't have as much of that activist core, and Google really doesn't have it. Google, and so that Google culture, and Google owns YouTube, and the Facebook culture that grew after Chris Hughes left didn't have those roots. And so you see it reflected in that. You see these sort of values reflected. There's a law in, which is sort of like a saying in computer science, which is Conway's law, which is the technology will reflect the institution that creates it. And we see the structures, the power dynamics, the both the capital and the workers and the users shaping how these platforms are created. And the corollary to Conway's law is the values of the technology we use will shape us. And so the values that are embedded in the affordances, the design and structure of Twitter shape people who use Twitter. The values and structure of TikTok shape the users of TikTok and shape our vision of the world and shape how we interact with people and how we build a political future. And so it's critically important that we find a way to build tools out of institutions that have the right set of values that prefigure the world we want, because that technology will then shape the building of new social movements and social change. It's sort of this cycle that could either be vicious if it puts us down into this sort of selfish, hateful world, or virtuous, in which as people use this technology, we shape them into a set of humane cultural values that define the inclusive, egalitarian future we're trying to build.
If you were in the U.S. Congress or something, like, and trying to find a relatively short-term solution to this whole problem, would you try to turn YouTube, Facebook, and into sort of regulated utilities, some kind of model like that?
It's a very tricky thing. So, I mean, in terms of policy, Ron Wyden, our senator here from Oregon, is probably the best in terms of the technology policy, but not perfect. The trick with heavy regulation is that it can have the effect of locking out new innovation and new things. And regulation benefits can sometimes it can be very good. Like the Consumer Protection Act in California has been very effective. GDPR in the UK, in Europe has been very effective. But often large corporations with lots of money and lobbyists and lawyers effectively use that regulation to prevent any competition from happening and locking themselves in. And so we have to be careful in our regulation of these utilities that we don't sort of make them sort of state-sanctioned legal monopolies.
Right.
Because then we're stuck with that set of values and we can't build new things. So the consolidation of all these companies and the is a problem. Like, we would all be better off if YouTube was not owned by Google. We would be better off if WhatsApp and Instagram and Oculus were not owned by Facebook. The size of these companies and their economies of scale and their ability to take innovation and basically use markets to crush alternatives is a big deal. But everything you hear the regulators or the proposals doing, the effect is just re-empowering these very large empowered incumbents. So it's really frustrating all around.
Yeah. I want to spend an hour talking about just this technology, social media stuff with you, if you would, sometime soon. Great. So we'll get you back on to talk about that. But for now, thank you so much for spending the hour and some on.
Yeah, and if everybody's watching this, stop watching videos and
calm down.
Like, there are still Black Lives Matter protests almost every night in every major city in this country. Like, they haven't stopped just because you're not seeing it in the news.
And what would you say, speaking of not seeing it in the news, I mean, it's I know where to find things around here, but it's not necessarily easily intuitive. I mean, do you have any particular advice for folks looking for the local protest?
Yeah, so there's a website, BLM PDX Events, that has an Instagram of the same name. If you Google that, you'll see the events, you'll see all the neighborhood events, you'll see a lot of the big stuff. They don't tend to announce the Black Bloc late night direct action things. Those tend to get passed around to different things, in part because no one is public about who's organizing it. There's not one set of people who are doing calls to action of choosing where it goes. Different people stand up on different nights. And because there's concern about conspiracy to riot charges and things like that. But if you're interested, the other one is Safe Protest PDX. If you search for that, you'll see it on Instagram, and they'll do announcements of when the actions are.
Thank you, Rebel.
Thank you so much.
Talk to you soon.
Yep. Bye-bye.
And thanks for tuning in to this discussion with indie media founder, protest DJ, and lovely guy, Rabel. And you can find this conversation archived on my YouTube channel and various other places. And if you look up This Week with David Rovics on any podcasting platform, you'll find it there. And I'll be back on Friday to talk with American Friends Service Committee, longtime activist from Massachusetts and author of the book Empire and the Bomb, Joe Gerson. And until then, remember, mutual aid will get us through. Don't pay the rent. Trust your neighbors. Talk to you soon. Take care. Bye for